VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll be discussing important wins for Wolves, Luton, Crystal Palace and a goal-fest victory for Aston Villa against Brighton. We'll also be looking at the return of the Women's Super League and joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got two of the finest football writers around, Alison Rudd and Molly Hudson, and a former footballer who was so good that he once won two Football League trophies without playing in either final. It's Gregor Robertson. I'm going to have to start making these up, I reckon, by the end of the season.
Probably in like 2 weeks' time.
Your career was pretty varied and you played for quite a lot of clubs, but I don't think we're going to make it to December. Molly, lovely to see you in the flesh, in person. Last time we were speaking, you were, I think, overlooking Sydney Harbour Bridge with maybe a little drink at the end of the Women's World Cup to celebrate, and I made you come on the podcast. And here you are in a grimy, windowless studio in the News UK buildings. This is better, right?
I spent a month at a Mercure that wasn't as nice as it sounded, so I think we'll take News UK. Very fancy staircase.
Yeah.
I said to Gregor, walking up here might be the poshest thing I've ever stood on.
There you go.
So look, we've gone up in the world.
We've quite literally gone up in the world because we came up a floor as well. So yeah, beautiful. Moving on from Australia and News UK studios to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, because it was the first big game that we're going to have to talk about. End-to-end action, red cards, own goals, and of course, refereeing cock-ups. Tottenham 2, Liverpool 1. And Alison Rudd, you've got an analogy for us.
This is a VAR analogy.
Yeah.
It doesn't analogize the whole game.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that a word?
Well, it is now.
Yeah, okay. It is now.
Okay, good.
Once it appears on the game podcast, it's a word.
It's in the OED now. Also, yeah. 3 seconds ago. They listen, assiduously to this. So, it is decided that lollipop ladies have had their day.
Right.
Been a few incidents, a few lorries going a bit too fast past schools. And the parents decide we want automated crossings for our children to get to school. We don't want a lady with a stick in the middle of the road. So what do? They build an automated school crossing system, but the people they put in the booths to monitor it are a group of pensioners who wanted to be involved in school crossings in the first place because they wanted to be outdoors, they wanted to meet people, they loved children and they cared for children's safety. But they're now in front of computer screens and having to concentrate really hard when they've just been to the WI cake sale and they're very busy and it doesn't work and a poor little kiddie gets maimed. And that is exactly what has happened with VAR, because let's remember, the referees didn't want it. This isn't a referee-led revolution in automated refereeing. It was the clubs and the authorities who wanted it. And for some bizarre reason, they decided to put your bog-standard referees in charge of what is a complicated system that requires quick reaction and no emotion whatsoever. And they've put buddies, all the buddies together in a room, and they're friends with the on-field referee, they're friends with each other. It doesn't work, and that whole system, and I've said it all along, and this just illustrates it, has to be recast completely.
So I presume in your analogy, the WI cake sale is the refereeing trip in the UAE that
indeed,
Darren
cleverly
England,
spotted.
Darren England and Dan Cook, the VAR officials at the centre of this controversy in Liverpool's defeat against Tottenham, of course, they were refereeing in the UAE only 48 hours earlier. That is Paul Joyce's and Martin Ziegler's story that you can read on the Times website now if you haven't seen it already, although I'm sure you have because it was all over social media last night. Lots of angry Liverpool fans saying, see, it's a conspiracy. Useless referees, but you do make a very good point that perhaps this is one of the issues that the people in the rooms making the decisions, pressing the buttons, looking at the footage, which we, and let's be honest, this isn't the first time we've seen this. Gregor, I mean, what can we say about this? Well, what can we say from, to take Alison's point about VAR and it being recast, what would your reaction be to that?
I mean, I would bend it all together.
Bin it.
But it's not going to happen. Like, we've said that for a while, so I don't think it's worth even having that conversation. But following on from Alison's point, it's almost like the logic as well that some footballers have or have historically had about only footballers, really, you know, people who've played the game knowing what they're talking about. Like I hate that logic, but also like you look at Howard Webb taking up the kind of position of the refereeing. The leader of the referee's body. Like, why do we think he's going to be the knight in shining armour? Because he was a good referee? Because he's a decent bloke?
Because like, he's been not... on Monday Night Football a couple of times, Gregor. Come on.
He seems like he's a good ref and he seems like a good bloke, but it's a different job to kind of overhaul the refereeing standards in this country and also, you know, using technology better. It's the same in terms of, you know, the VAR operation as well. It's like, why do we think it should just be referees who are in the booth? I know you have to know the rules, but I think probably, you know, a fair, like a mastery of the technology and sort of understanding or certainly better implementing the systems to get to the right decisions is the most important thing. They don't have to be former refs.
Yeah, this is part of your point that you've always made, Alison, to be fair to you, that you can bring technology in, but if the humans doing the technology are the same as the humans on the pitch, then you're still going to get the same problems, isn't it? What do you think to Gregor's idea of having people in the booths who aren't necessarily referees? They might have more knowledge of the technology and know the rules, but haven't necessarily been out on the pitch. Do you think that matters?
No, you have someone in the room, an overseer who knows the intricacies of football laws, which there aren't that many of them, really. Well. Very few of them are complicated, and a lot of it is about interpretation of the laws, and that's why you have the referee on the pitch going to the monitor. That isn't a perfect system either, but I think the idea that referees who are currently refereeing are then pushed into a room with lots of computer gadgets and expected to work out quickly and efficiently the right thing to do. It's like somebody doing a degree in drama then becoming a surgeon. You go through the pathway, don't you? You do what you're good at. I think it should be when you're watching any football game live, whether it's Sky or TNT or whatever, we take it for granted how brilliantly that's conveyed to us. You know, razor sharp graphics. We see the pictures of everything. Everyone's identified properly. Subs are made. You get a lovely indication straight away of who's going on, who's coming off. It's all, you know, slickly produced. You go to the studio. You go back to the match. You have a little shot maybe of the commentator in the stand. It's all done so slickly. Why can't those people who bring us the TV be also the people that operate the VAR? Because they would do it. They're used to pressure. They're used to knowing that you need to react incredibly quickly. They know what's needed. They understand football because they're bringing it to us almost on a daily basis. Why are the refereeing body put in charge of the VAR? I don't think referees, apart from an overseer who knows the laws, should be there at all.
Very interesting. To kind of take that point about who's involved and how they've tried to change VAR, Molly, one of the things in the Women's World Cup that we saw was a desire for added transparency, if you like. Referees speaking over the kind of tannoy system in the stadiums to try and explain decisions. That was fraught with errors where sometimes they started speaking and the crowd would react to the decision as it came up on the screen, so you then couldn't hear the decision. Transparency was a word used in Liverpool's statement last night, and it's something that Johnny Northcroft, our colleague, picked up on social media, saying that, you know, in other sports, in cricket, you can hear the decision being made and how it's been made. In rugby, similarly, when these decisions are discussed. What was your view in the Women's World Cup of how that that attempt at transparency went down within football?
I think fundamentally the problem with VAR at the minute is everything you try and do with it creates another problem. So as you say, part of particularly my frustration from being in the ground, I'm not 100% sure how it was for you guys listening to it sort of on the TV. But yeah, the crowd obviously react to what the referee is saying. And also at the World Cup, you had a lot of referees that English wasn't even their first language, but so they're being asked to communicate in English, which then makes it harder for them. Kind of what Alison was just saying about a referee doesn't sign up to be in a small room, probably a bit like this. they also don't sign up to speak to the fans directly through their microphone. You know, that's something else that we're putting on them when we're already sort of arguing that maybe referees are getting things wrong. Well, now we're just making their job even harder for them. But I think for me, going back to the Liverpool incident, I think the big thing that sort of opened my eyes, and maybe it's because, you know, I don't spend hours of my week researching this stuff, is the communication. I think the communication is the main issue, because I was reading Peter Walton's column for us this morning, and he was saying part of the problem where the confusion came from the VAR official not realising the on-field decision, you can't actually say goal or no goal, because there's a chance you could miss the no at the start and misinterpret it. And now that's basically exactly what's happened, that he's misinterpreted that even without that. So, like, how do you make that system foolproof? Because it's supposed to be a yes or a no decision. You're either onside or offside, which I think is the things about VAR that has actually worked. I don't particularly like it when it's a subjective thing, when it's down to interpretation, because we can still sit here for an hour every Monday and argue it.
But I'm going to try not to, I promise. But yeah, keep going.
But I think that's kind of like, if there's still room for error, then what is the point?
Imagine the dread of these guys when they realised what they'd done. And also, the referee as well. It must have influenced the way he officiated the rest of the game.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have just been sitting with their heads in their hands, thinking, "How has this possibly happened?" And it's such a bad look. It's, you know, we talk about the sort of the standard of the Premier League, and, you know, being the best league in the world and everything. It's such a bad look for officiating standards to be so low and shambolic at times this season.
Well, that's a big topic of conversation amongst our writers on the Times website this morning. Forget technology, better humans are needed. Howard Webb needs to find them, says Martin Samuel. Pay more and recruit ex-pros. How to fix the referee shambles, says Henry Winter. Gregor, tempted? I reckon you probably get more money than we pay you to do this, so that'd be a start.
No, I mean, you know, there was a line in I read Martin's column this morning, there's a line that leapt out to me, and it was, it cannot be that everybody who played the game doesn't know the rules. So, Alison, you're saying the rules are simple. I completely disagree. I think the rules need overhauled as well, because some of them are so complicated and convoluted. And also, that's not even the most important thing. It's also that players look at a lot of decisions now and think and disagree with them. And I know it's not just, you know, it's not just former players or current players who should decide what's right and wrong, but when so many people say, look at, for example, Curtis Jones' red card, and say that was a kind of
a mistake. That wouldn't have
happened. But that sounds old fashioned. But it's his foot rolled off the top of the ball, and I know there's been a kind of gradual shift towards, like, it almost doesn't matter how your studs are planted on the player's leg. You know, you could win the ball first and plant your studs in the player's leg and still be sent off these days. But people are shouting, thinking, this is not right. This isn't. You can't play football and not try and compete to win the ball and be competitive and strong in a challenge sometimes. So I think Martin's fundamental point there is the rules are wrong if so many players and current and former players think they're wrong.
Yeah, but just to back to that point, we talked on last week's show about coaching and your decisions after your career. and you know how that is quite often like a reflex for a lot of former players. I presume there's never really any chat in the dressing room, you know, amongst the lads in their 30s. Oh, I'm going to give refereeing a crack.
No, I know, I know one former teammate who played, who I played with, who did the qualification, but then went into coaching. The thing I would agree with in Henry's is pay them more. If you want to make it a real kind of profession with high standards, like most things, most kind of industries, you need to reward them. And I think that would possibly, you know, be more alluring to players who played in League One and League Two, for example, who, you know, you see the opportunity to earn a decent living, and a very good living, in fact, if you become a professional referee.
Well, Molly, we mentioned players becoming referees. Hawa Sissoko, the West Ham defender in the Women's Super League, you interviewed her. Honestly, this was one of my favourite stories you've ever rang in and told me about on the editing desk. You said, right, hear me out. She's got the most red cards in the Women's Super League. Guess what she wants to do after she stops playing? And I was like, I don't know, go far, far away and forget all about football. And you were like, no, she wants to be a referee. I mean, that's pretty unique, isn't it?
Yeah, the best bit of the story is that this must have been like a 15, 20 minute interview. We're all huddled around her at this like Women's Super League media day. And she's spent like 14 of these 15 minutes basically saying the rest are crap. I'm not aggressive, you know, I've got all these red cards, but it was their fault, it wasn't my fault. Which, if you actually look at the red cards, I think they were red cards, right, in defence of the officials. And then she actually says, I'm going to tell you a secret. I'd like to be a ref. And we're just like, what?
Are you mad?
But I think fundamentally her point was, not only does she want to be a ref, she'd just like to speak to the ref. She feels as though the only times players really speak to officials, and you'd know this better than I, is when you're in a match in the heat of the moment and you probably disagree with what they've just said to you or whatever. And it's not a real time to have a proper discussion about the rules, the laws, whatever. And just more like person to person. She was saying like she felt as though that dynamic isn't right, and that's why some of those issues come up then on the pitch, because maybe she feels as though she is seen as an aggressive player when she isn't. But basically she was saying, we just need to talk more. We need to communicate off the pitch. We need to understand more. I don't know if that's something that you think would...
I think it would improve it, but only in terms of when it's coming to drafting the laws, because the referees have to go by the laws of the game. That's how they have to officiate, which is correct. But in terms of discussion on the field of play, I don't think I've said this many times. I don't think players should be allowed to speak to the referee. I think it should just be the captain, because it's an awful look when referees are being harangued. But at the same time, it's kind of almost understandable now, because when you see some of the decisions that are being made, it must be infuriating.
Well, there you go, Game podcast listeners. Former players becoming referees, change the rules and get some people from outside of football to be in the booth with them. We tried to come up with some solutions to the problems on the show this morning and not just get angry about it. Although we are still going to talk about the game, so there's chance for Alison Rudd yet. On to the action itself, because it was also a thriller. Again, Tottenham and Ange Postecoglou delivering the goods. Alison, coming to you on Liverpool and, let's say, the red cards, and obviously this controversy comes into it as well. How well do you think they kind of handled the kind of fevered nature in the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? Because that is going to become a thing, I think, under Postecoglou. The crowd are so behind them and the team at the minute. Obviously, that Curtis Jones red card, potentially slightly harsh. Do you think it was a difficult afternoon for Liverpool or really bad luck? Obviously, Joel Matip sticking one in his own net didn't help. But
no. Until that very late own goal, I did feel Liverpool were going to at least escape with a point, because there was that sense of, well, they'd already done it at St James's Park, which is just as febrile an atmosphere,
yep,
actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, if you know you can do that down to 10 men and you're away from home, well, that gives you something to cling on to. I thought Klopp reacted really quickly and set the team up well. So there was a bank of five and then three in front, but with always with the opportunity for a counter-attack. It's hard to... I mean, And then when you go down to, Jota gets sent off and you go down to 9, that's slightly different to 10, actually. But I mean, I'm biased, but I did think, wow, you know, Spurs are not making any headway here. This is concentrated defending, which is slightly ironic because it's not the thing Liverpool are good at this season. I do feel if they're going to win the title, it'll simply be because they just score more goals per game and let loads in as well, but not quite as many as they score. So I just thought, wow, this is one hell of an effort in, as you say, Tom, a difficult place to go now. And it just felt extra painful that it was an own goal, really. And I don't blame Matip. It's, you know, he's doing his best. But I'd like to think most neutrals watching would have thought, I'd quite like Liverpool not to lose this, because
good luck with that one.
Well, there are neutrals in football.
To be fair, Molly was nodding along to that point.
No, I kind of agree. Look, I agree. I think Liverpool arguably sort of emerged with more credit than Spurs from this game, because you know, I think Gary Neville mentioned in commentary that it could have ruined the game when Curtis Jones was sent off, because it was a great opening half an hour. You know, Liverpool had brilliant chances on the break. Spurs were dominating large spells of possession, but maybe not. They fashioned one or two openings, but Liverpool still looked really threatening on the break. And it was beautifully poised and balanced the game. But the sending off didn't ruin the game. Liverpool still managed to offer that threat on the break. They still looked solid defensively.
Scored a great goal.
Yeah, indeed. And even with 9 men, it was like a training session. They defended the box, and Spurs kind of kept working around the box. And any time they tried to get into the box, they met the red wall. So it was a moment of kind of this huge ill fortune and sort of tiredness, swinging a leg at the ball that changed the game, that changed the result. But I think Liverpool deserve credit from this.
You mentioned ill fortune for Liverpool. I'm going to, you know, and this isn't my view, Tottenham fans, before you take your headphones out and throw your phone across the room, but 2-1 at home to Sheffield United with sendings off Sheffield United and late goals, 2-2 against Arsenal, now this result as well. Is it, this shows what Ange Postecoglou's doing with Tottenham? They're a big team now, they're going to win big games, they find a way to win, or are they being a bit lucky, Gregor?
No, they have been a bit lucky, absolutely. They certainly were in this one. In other games they have shown sort of real fortitude and sort of continued belief, and what he keeps saying about just keeping playing our football has been true. In this game it wasn't, because they kept trying to play their football and it wasn't working. Having said all that, in the first half I was watching this game thinking, you know, you talk about teams often trying to get overloads in wide areas, attacking fullbacks, sometimes one inverted fullback. I've never seen, it's hard to think of a team who flood the middle of the pitch as much as Spurs now. It's like both fullbacks step in. Sometimes Romero steps out from centre half, and they have a midfield three, and they just kind of constantly try and find ways through the opposition in the middle of the pitch to then go wide. And it worked at times as well in the first half, but as I said at the start, I think Liverpool almost deserve more credit from this game despite the result.
Molly, finishing with you, first time on the show this season, Tottenham second, Liverpool fourth at the moment. What is your overall assessment of these two teams? Very early to say, but where do you think they're going to be heading towards? Top four title contenders towards the end of the season?
I don't know if this is slightly avoiding the question, but
almost certainly.
Probably. I was listening to you and Gregor then, and it reminded me, obviously it was in Australia when the season actually started, and obviously there's a huge interest in Ange coming to the Premier League and all of that. And I actually watched the first Spurs game in a pub with a Spurs fan who was also a reporter who I won't name for her benefit. But it was like they almost felt like the season was like a bit dead already. Like Ange had been like hamstrung already. Like Kane was gone. You know when you turn on the TV at the start of a new season, you're like, who's that? Like, when did they sign him? Where's he come from? And it was like a bit like that with the Spurs team in particular. Obviously, we'd been in Australia for about 6 weeks at that point, so I'm not sure we knew what was actually going on. But it did feel a bit like that, and like the first game wasn't amazing. I think Vicario wasn't great in goal, and we just kind of thought, well, this is all a bit rubbish, isn't it? And then I think you literally come a matter of weeks down the line and you see how it's been transformed and you say, well, are they actually as good as we think they are? Well, I think a Spurs fan would say, well, it doesn't really matter. We're actually having a good time.
Mm.
Like, I think you kind of forget in modern football that aside from maybe the Manchester Cities of this world and, yeah, I guess the Liverpools too recently, that, you know, you're always constantly going for winning trophies. But what about the teams that are just below that, that just want to enjoy watching their football team? And I know, obviously, Tottenham have aspirations to win that elusive trophy. But for now, can we not just kind of enjoy the ride a little bit? And I think that's what they're doing. I think that's why, yes, they might not be playing incredible. And, yeah, I did think they kind of struggled with against the nine players of Liverpool who were fantastic. But it's kind of fun, isn't it? See where they go.
It's certainly fun. And Liverpool are fun as well, scoring lots of goals, as Alison mentioned. Do you think that'll be enough? We'll score more than you?
Yeah. But I think it does come. It comes down to the big games, doesn't it?
Mm.
Because
still in our hands.
Yeah.
It's ours to lose. It's ours to lose. Well, another team who would say it's definitely ours to lose is Manchester City, beaten by Wolves at the weekend, 2-1. Charlotte Dunker, in her match report for the Sunday Times, said that a City side without Rodri missing through suspension after his slightly ludicrous red card against Nottingham Forest did not look the same, and Wolves executed a game plan to a tee which saw them set up with a back five and suffocated City on every occasion. Gregor, a Gary O'Neill masterclass, wasn't it?
Kind of, yeah.
No, I mean, Poor Gary, he's probably listening thinking this is my big moment, I've beaten Pep Guardiola.
Well, look, they repelled everything that City threw at them, which is not as much as they might have expected, and kept Erling Haaland remarkably quiet, which was a big thing as well. And Charlotte's right. I mean, she mentioned some stats about how City's sort of win percentage falls dramatically without Rodri, and he does add that impetus. Although he's the man at the base of midfield, he's the one who kind of inject a bit of pace and can play forwards quickly, and you look at City's team and you know Kovacic's new, Nunez new, Doku's new, there's a few, you know, it's not the kind of familiar winning machine that we were so used to in recent seasons. There've been quite a few changes over the summer, and that creates a bit of sort of uncertainty, I would say, in their team. So, but from Will's point of view, yeah, that Gary O'Neill is, as I said a couple of weeks ago, I think he's a coach with a really high ceiling. I think you can see when you're watching his games live, the kind of sort of like micro detail, the little details he's sort of he's working on the sidelines, trying to drag players across, kind of little targeted pressing triggers, things like that. He's really on top of things on the touchline, and there's always a really solid structure that Wolves start from, and they've got players who are good in the break, like Cunha and Neto, whose pace was just terrifying for City and for Ake in particular in this game. So brilliant result for Wolves, and a bit of a rubbish week for Man City.
Yeah.
The key though for Wolves, I thought, because I think they've played well without getting the results all season, the key was that they kept the pressure on for the full match. They've wilted in the final quarter of games, as though Gary O'Neill has a plan, and it's a good plan, but they haven't got the energy to see it through to the end, and then they sort of wilt. But clearly they've been working on their ability to pace themselves and their fitness. If they can do what they've been doing and do it for the full, I'm trying to avoid saying for the full,
the
90,
full 90
because it doesn't exist as a term anymore. It's completely meaningless. For the full 108 minutes, then they will do really well, I think, because that's been the problem. They have been one of, I mean, we've banged on this podcast about, you know, Brighton being the team to watch. I think Wolves have not been far behind with their pace on the break. They've been joyous to watch, but they've just not had it
and
in
goals.
Them to do the whole.
Sometimes they can't turn those periods.
But if they can
if
they can keep that going, the plan going for the full 128 minutes, then then they'll be fine, better than fine this season, I think. And what are Bournemouth thinking, having decided?
Well, exactly.
He was just too boring for them.
Well, you've teed up perfectly for my next question, because Molly Hudson, as we were preparing for this show, she said, make sure you ask me about Gary O'Neill. Bloody love Gary O'Neill. Tell us why, Molly.
Well, I watched Bournemouth last season, did a few of their games, thought, he's doing a perfectly good job here. In fact, he's doing a more than perfectly good job here, because a few of us might have thought they were going down, and they didn't. They comfortably stayed up, and then they got rid of him. Why? Because he's not fashionable. I hate to sound like a bit of a dinosaur. But
it's
like,
fine, you're in your 20s, you can get away with that kind
exactly,
of
thing. Right? He's winning games.
He wasn't winning games. I mean, that's why they got rid of him, because once they were secure in the Premier League, they didn't win. They just didn't win.
Which comes
back
to
enough
that
games.
Point about your intensity point, maybe, about being able to keep it up. That'll be a challenge then for him this season. If you then, that you know, you beat Manchester City, having, let's be honest, lost to Ipswich in the Cup, drawn with Luton, lost to Liverpool, lost to Palace, beat Manchester City, great, amazing. Then what are you going to do? That is maybe part of it as well, in terms of his standing as a manager.
Oh, no, absolutely. But I have faith in him, because let's remember, he's a new manager. Mm. He's not been doing it that long. And he had a lot on his plate when he was promoted to first-team coach at Bournemouth, but not least the fact they were a team that had been slaughtered at Anfield. And as you say, Molly, everyone wrote them off. That takes quite a lot of man management skills to convince your team that they're actually good enough to start getting results together.
And he was only interim too, wasn't he? And he, like, speaking to him, he was very like measured. He never spoke about trying to want to get the job, and he got the job by doing his job. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And that's quite refreshing. Sometimes we look too far ahead instead of actually going, right, game by game, win this game, you're in a better position.
But do you think that speaks of I think he probably has quite good self-confidence, because he's not changed.
He doesn't need
the way,
to say it.
He's not changed the way he plays at Wolves, even though the results were looking terrible. But he liked what he saw and knew it had to turn.
What's he like in press conferences after matches, Gregor? Really, Gregor,
really
you
measured.
Did
calm.
The recent one.
Really measured, even you know in victory and in defeat. He did speak up a little bit, I think, in midweek after the defeat to Ipswich, saying that, like, you know, we've lost some big players, and you know, not had much coming the other way, so this is always going to be a difficult campaign, and it will be, you know, it will be inconsistent. The lack of goals is going to be a recurring issue, I think. Despite Neto's form this season has been outstanding, and you know, he came back, I think, from about 10 months out, I think, in February last season.
If he gets injured again, ouch.
And he's so he's kind of building up fitness. I think he must have had a good pre-season, and He's electric.
Yeah, that run was like a PlayStation goal, wasn't it? Where you're smashing the like speed button, go. Yeah.
So with the kind of structure they have, and as I mentioned the other week, João Gomes in midfield alongside Lamina, they are two real kind of ankle snapping midfielders who, you know, they rat around and they do all the dirty work and provide a platform for Neto and Cunha as well, who is another player who's a brilliant ball carrier, but just, you know, not always clinical enough in front of goal. So, you know, as I said before, I think goals will continue to be an issue for them, but really good kind of foundations for this team, though.
We need to give a shout out to the Wolves social media team with the Korean guy. I don't know if you guys saw it. In his pre-match press conference, Pep had forgotten the name of Hwang Hee-chan and just called him the Korean guy when he was like listing players. Literally just forgot his name, just didn't even think, just said the Korean guy. He scores, obviously, the winner, and the social media team put the graphic of the player and then the Korean guy.
Fantastic. Nothing wrong with a little dig at Pep Guardiola, especially in defeat. We've got to keep him honest, haven't we? From one young manager doing very well to one slightly older, Roy Hodgson. 1-0 win for Crystal Palace at Old Trafford. It's about peak Roy Hodgson as you could get, Alison Rudd, wasn't it? Losing in the cup in the week. Man United and Erik ten Hag are thinking, yes, off we go, here we go, our season starts now. Oh no, it doesn't. Along comes Roy with a perfect defensive masterclass.
Well, we have a rule in my living room. The Rudd rule is, if you face someone in the cup close to the league game, the results will always be the opposite.
Right.
So I had no doubt at all that Palace would win this, But when I had lunch recently with Roy Hodgson,
yes,
that epic lunch.
Posh lunch.
And indeed quite posh. Although actually, I think it was good value, you know. But anyway, I said to him, oh, you know, as you get towards, I mean, he's obviously nowhere near the end of his career because he's only 76, but as he gets towards the end of his career, it would be nice to win silverware in England, which he's not done. And he was sort of like, well, not really. I mean, because he was about to go to Old Trafford in the EFL Cup. And he said, well, you know, it's a game I have to play my fringe players in, otherwise they'll be cross. They need exposure and a chance to prove themselves. And he said, I would much rather win the league game. So he wasn't feeling it for the cup game. Yeah. He just wasn't feeling it. He was feeling it for this, though, completely concentrated on how to do it. Obviously, someone who's more than any other manager, undefeated in his visits to Old Trafford. He feels very comfortable going there. And it's almost like a touch of magic because it's not supposed to happen, is it? They seem to get these results with wonder goals, and you can't plan for those. They're always wonderful goals.
And it was
beautifully taken. It was
a
great strike, wasn't it? But they're always great strikes, aren't they? They're always great strikes when Crystal Palace get a result away from home at a big club. But it's like, I'm sort of contradicting myself in a way. That can't be the plan, to rely on a wonder goal. That should never be the plan. And yet, because it happens so consistently, it's based on not being scared also to be defensive and well organised, and to have faith in a variety of players at Palace who we've discussed in the past do have flair and great technical ability, and knowing that you will frustrate a club that aren't in peak happiness, really.
I mean, there's not much to be scared of when you go to Old Trafford these days, though. That's the only thing, is it?
Getting rained on.
Yes.
If you're a fan.
Hey, come on, don't start with
this. Well, that was telling, wasn't it? Who was the most soaked manager? It was the old guy prepared to stand in the rain to cajole his team on, and Eric Ten Hag didn't look wet at all. He spent most of the time sat down looking at a screen.
I think Molly's referencing the leaks in the roof, though, weren't you? There was pictures on social media of that as well. Fans,
he's got enough problems, Eric Ten Hag, without picking on him for not being brave enough to stand in the rain. Poor guy.
Don't you think that's indicative?
It potentially is. But just quickly on to Palace, because we've talked so much about Manchester United, and I genuinely do think it's not that surprising a result. So on Palace, my only thing for Hodgson and Palace is, with this result, as we say, it is so Roy Hodgson, it is so Crystal Palace, that the last time he was at Crystal Palace, this was a little bit of almost part of the reason he kind of moved on, and the club were happy to move on, because they'd had it, not enough of Roy Hodgson and Crystal Palace, but they wanted to try something else. They wanted to try a newer manager, a younger manager in Patrick Vieira, and then they came back to him to save them. Do you see where I'm going? And kind of, how far do you keep going with this before it then becomes, oh, we've kind of used to Roy and his 1-0 wins at Old Trafford and us finishing 16th? Because you say about not winning a cup, I want to win the league match. That is embedded, surely, in the idea that he wants to just survive and keep them in the league. So how...
Not necessarily. I think he genuinely feels he's done that. Let's finish mid-table or just below and survive with an ageing team. Now he's got a young team with a lot of talent in it, and he is very excited by who is in the team. There's a lot more youth and endeavour and coveted players in that team, and I think he believes he can shift up the places, and that matters to him a lot. I don't think he wants to become that cliche Tom where, oh, you know, he's a safe pair of hands, but it's a bit boring.
The young players, the Elises, the Ezes, are what's keeping
him. No, he loves them.
Gregor, Crystal Palace then, just finally on you. What do you think they can be, should be, going forward this season? Or will they just be Roy Hodgson's super goals from Joachim Andersen and out of nowhere, and wins at Old Trafford and Stamford Bridge and the like?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fairly consistent in this. I completely get everything Alisson's saying, and he's done a remarkable job, continues to. I think they will be kind of happy to survive every year and very little else. I know there's excitement about several young players, and they have got a lot of attack and flair, and they can be really good to watch. But I still think fundamentally that by appointing Roy Hodgson, there's an admission that survival is the aim.
nothing wrong with a bit of survival. One club who will be definitely hoping to do more than survive this season, but dare I say it, at this early stage, nothing can be undecided, is Chelsea. They play Fulham tonight, of course, but before that, if you're listening to us before that match, or even after that match, especially if they've lost, you will definitely want to check out Tom Roddy and Matt Lawton's story. The inside story, in fact, of what has gone wrong for Chelsea this season. Those guys take you behind the scenes. You can read that story on the Times website now. And all the best of the weekend reaction from all of these guys. Stick with us. Up next, we're talking Luton, Villa and the Women's Super League.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and I'm joined by Molly Hudson, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. Gregor Robertson, of course, a former defender. And Tom Lockyer must have scored for Luton Town in their win against Everton, the defender's favourite ever goal, where he's basically scored by blocking a big clearance and it's gone straight into the net. I mean, that's the dream, isn't it? I know last week you talked about scoring from a corner, but sliding in the rain for a hero's block and it actually flies into the top corner, that's as good as it gets, isn't it?
Absolutely. They all count. Quickest to react, though, he was. If you look at it, you know,
absolutely.
Ashley Young controlled it and kind of on the line and thought he was going to have time to clear it, but Lockyer was zoning in and threw everything he had at it and got an all-important opening goal.
And he's had a black eye since he was 4 and a half.
He's all got a black eye indeed, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, recovered from that heart scare during the summer as well, so great for him to be scoring in Luton's first win and a great moment for them. I should also give a mention to Carlton Morris, who I cast aspersions over in our preview show, that having seen him in League One, he might not be good enough for the Premier League. But that's 2-2 now, and an excellent goal for him as well. This is a big moment for Luton, isn't it, Gregor?
Yeah.
You know, we've discussed them on the show recently in the light of all three promoted teams. You and Alison had a bit of a debate about what their goals were, what their ambitions were. This is a big statement from Rob Edwards, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's been a bit of sneering at Luton already, and you know, it's kind of understandable.
Didn't look at Alison when you said that.
No, I don't. Just I think a lot of people have kind of looked at them and thought, what did they spend the best about 20 million, I think, on players. You know, the wage bill is still probably, I think it's about 30 million. It's just nothing compared to some of their opponents, and it wouldn't be much in the Championship. So people think that they're almost not trying. You know, they're kind of drawing parallels with when Norwich tried to do something prudent financially, shall we say, when they came up a few years back. But Luton are a bit different. Luton's journey has been extraordinary, and they also, I think also it kind of misread a lot of their performances. There'll been a lot of their games have lost because of individual errors. And I know it's easy to say, you just cut out the errors and you know you'll start to find some results. But it's kind of true. And a lot of these guys haven't played in the Premier League and they're still finding their feet and they're getting used to the pace. Rob Edwards said it's like a different sport after the draw against Wolves last week, which they dominated the shot count, I think it was 20-3, and should have won. And they're creating chances, and they've always had. I wrote it after the opening game of the season at Brighton, which everyone looked at. I think it was 4-1. I thought, oh, you know, Brighton have blown them away. They didn't. Luton were always in that game until like the 84th minute or 5th minute when...
It was fun to watch, they weren't getting battered.
Absolutely. And they've got a solid structure, and it's the same kind of thing as we saw in the Championship last year. And they've got... They were always really good at set pieces, and that's, you know, that's been an area that Rob Edwards has said on a couple of occasions we need to make better use of, particularly in this league. And they're starting to do that. And Alfie Doughty's deliveries in this game, the left wing backs, were outstanding. And they've got some big guys like Carlton Morris ready to get on the end of them. So, yeah, look, it's going to be difficult for them, but I always thought it's a bit hasty to write them off. And this was a big win for them, absolutely.
Everton, Alison, we talk about Wolves and that big win against Manchester City, and I was then suggesting, well, you've got to keep it up. Everton, big win against Brentford last week, then winning the cup against Aston Villa. Bloody hell, they beat Aston Villa. Sean Dyche has turned it around. Oh no, he hasn't. He's lost at Goodison Park, the fortress that it is, Goodison Park.
Well, that's the point. It's not a fortress, is it?
But exactly. That was going to be my question. We've talked so much about how the importance of Goodison Park, when you're getting beaten at home by little old Luton, that's not a good look, is it?
No, it's bad, really bad, and really worrying, and it's a bit topsy-turvy. If I was an Everton fan, I would read a lot more into this defeat than the victory over Brentford, who were uncharacteristically shocking. And I felt in that game Everton almost won in spite of themselves. You know, they couldn't help but win, did they? I'm not sure they exactly knew how they did it either. And the point is to build and to take some of the positivity back to your home stadium. It is going to be their home stadium for another season and a half at least. And it's decrepit and rubbish, but it's got soul and it's got history and it's got the ability to turn games they don't deserve to win into winning games, because it can be... It can be a difficult place for the opposing team. It's quite intimate and quite scary at times. Actually, partly because you think it's going to fall down on top of you, but it's part of the list of things you've got going in your favour if you're a struggling team, which Everton are. So I think I don't think you can sort of like balance the books and say, well, we got a good away win, but so it doesn't matter so much that we lost at home. It was a game they were supposed to win, and probably that is part of the problem. Everton have, over the past couple of seasons, just got that slight unlikely result, that sense of them all coming together in spite of the flaws and the problems at the club. They're able to summon pride when it comes to a big match or a match against a team that are doing much better than them. And if they can't do that against a team they're supposed to defeat, I'm not saying Luton are just awful. I'm saying in terms of, you know, the financials and the history and the fact that Everton have been in the Premier League forever and Luton have not, you're supposed to win it. And if you can't find a way, and not only that, but as you find the game is unravelling slightly, you're not able to come together and make it work. You know, pull your socks up halfway through. You know, I think Paul Joyce used the word limp. Pretty sure he did. You've just got to be better as a unit. And if you're going to not be able to lift yourselves for the games against the clubs that are around you in the table, then I think that's sort of slightly doom-laden, really.
Well, teams around you in the table, they face Bournemouth at home next, and maybe we're suggesting that Sean Dyche has actually decided they've better away from home. Anfield next as the next away game for Everton. So it's a difficult 2 weeks. They're going to need to turn it around. We're going to talk about Villa, and I'm not sure quite what the question should be. 6-1 against Brighton. I go back, as I often have done in recent shows, to our preview show, and we kind of cast these two teams together. Mm. Exciting. Everyone else's favourite team. Mm. I mean, Unai Emery and Aston Villa are blowing Brighton out of the water on this one, aren't they? Particularly in recent weeks. Gregor, you've talked a lot about the kind of talent, the exciting attacking play that Unai Emery's got in his team. Throughout his career, he's known as being solid, winning European trophies with teams like Sevilla by being very solid, hard to beat. Villa are an incredibly exciting team to watch, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there was a kind of combination of both of those things. There was the not really playing Brighton at their own game or being sucked into you know, as Brighton try and draw you in to exploit spaces in behind, they didn't play that game, and they chose the times to go and press or to capitalise on an error and flooded bodies forward. And as I've said a few times, they've got so much pace now when they do that with Diaby and Watkins, Zaniolo as well on the left. And Watkins was pretty clinical. I mean, Brighton did gift them a couple of goals here. There were some really bad mistakes. But Watkins was really clinical. And it was interesting, actually, in Paul Rowan's piece today, he was saying about how Watkins has been watching Haaland and how he's kind of been impressed by his patience, how he can go, we've said so many times in this podcast, he hardly does anything for like half an hour at a time. And he was saying he's been kind of amazed that he can go for, you know, 20 minutes or whatever without really touching the ball, but still being alert and on, you know, ready to explode into action when he's needed. And that's kind of, there are periods in games where he has to do that for Villa, because they do sometimes, depending on the opposition, they do sometimes sit in a fairly low block, and it's all about picking the right moments to press and to break.
He does look like a player who has and does really work at his game as well. And I also thought it was telling for the last goal that he's cleaned through, had a hat-trick, hits it kind of straight at the keeper. And as the goal's gone in, is it Douglas Luiz who kind of passes it into the net? He's kind of, Watkins isn't celebrating, he's beating the floor. He's going, damn it, I could have had another one, which would have been great for me because I kept him in my fantasy football team. How good do you think he is / can be? You know, he's talking about watching other players, he's talking about working on himself.
It's all about consistency with him. He is a hell of a player. He's got everything. He's got explosive pace, strength. You know, he's got a trick. He can score. He can make a goal for himself. He's not just a finisher, but he is a finisher as well. It's just about doing it over a consistent period and like, you know, for a couple of seasons really in a row for it in the Premier League. Actually, you know, he's in talks with over a new contract. It would be interesting to kind of think who might kind of have their interest piqued by this if he doesn't sign a deal, and what the next step could potentially be for him.
Chelsea, the way they go on. Well, if he scores another hat-trick,
then it'd be
good.
Terrible as soon as he went there. Yeah.
Well, I think there'd be a lot of teams in the Premier League would want an Ollie Watkins, absolutely. And he's confident too. His quotes were quite punchy after the game about, you know, well, Gareth Southgate was obviously there watching the game, and he's saying, you know, people said, you know, because he scored a hat-trick against Hibs, and they're saying, oh, it's only against Hibs. He's like, this won't be my last hat-trick of the season either, and there's not a scored against a top five team, what more can I do?
Just on Brighton, Alison, again, going back to that preview show, you were very excited about their season, said, don't worry about Europe, don't worry, it'll be brilliant. Since those high points of beating Newcastle and Manchester United 3-1, lost to AEK Athens, beat Bournemouth at home, even conceded a goal against Chelsea in the cup, which is basically the worst thing you could do in football at the minute, and then lost this game. I mean, 6-1, you know, we talked recently about Newcastle and 8-0s. 6-1, it's not a great look. Any worries about Brighton, your beloved second team, Brighton?
They're Gregor's beloved second team. Let's not go down that road. I have a lot of beloved second teams. Brighton, just about to scrape onto the list, really. They are, when they're good, they're very, very good, and when they're bad, they're horrid. And I think De Zerbi is, I think he's a very meticulous and stroke emotional manager at the same time. And sometimes one of those wins, and I think he over rotates. I think he's getting used to balancing increase matches. Basically, if you're going to rotate a lot on the back of having lost some of your best players, there will be games where it just doesn't click. I think that's an acceptable thing to have happened to them, actually. I mean, 6-1 isn't great, but it's when it fails, it fails. May as well, it could be 2-1, so it doesn't matter, because I think they will keep bouncing.
You sound
back.
Like Paul Heckingbottom now. Doesn't matter, it's just a defeat.
I was in the company of Paul Heckingbottom, as he said, that's probably why. But I don't think this is indicative of it's all gone wrong for Brighton. I think we will see them win against someone they shouldn't win against quite handsomely, and everyone will be drooling over them again. It's going to be that sort of season because they're just getting used to. It's their first ever in their history European campaign, and they have lost some key players, and they are integrating a whole variety of different players with different experience. So it's going to collapse occasionally.
You talk very quickly about beating teams and us getting excited. I mean, this is a run of four fixtures. Marseille away, Liverpool at home, Manchester City away, Ajax at home. I mean,
ouch.
If they pull up a win in one of those, you'll be absolutely right. But it is incredibly exciting, isn't it, for Brighton? Yeah. Sorry, Gregor, you were just going to come back to Alison's point.
No. I mean, it's about maintaining the positivity, because there was almost this feeling of invincibility about Brighton towards the end of last season and at the start of this season, let's be honest. So that's quite fragile. And, you know, it's about maintaining... I agree about De Zerbi's sort of emotional side as well. I've often, you know, watched Brighton a lot, and I think this guy is the real deal. He could go to the very top, like, as a manager, because he's innovative, he's intense, he's like, he's all the things that an elite manager is, but he's a little bit reckless. And, you know, he's had a couple of touchline bans, I think. You see how emotional he is in the touchline. But I just wonder whether sometimes it might stray a bit too far. So I think it is about keeping the positivity of Brighton just now. It's not a disaster for them, and it is to be expected.
Too soon to extrapolate anything from seven games in the Premier League. You ain't seen nothing yet, Gregor, because we're moving on to the Women's Super League. First match of the season. Who's going to win the league? Who's going to go down? And what are the stories going to be? Molly Hudson looking at me like, honestly, you are an idiot sometimes, honestly. But no, the Women's Super League is back this weekend. Big game, Arsenal v Liverpool, packed Emirates, and Liverpool go and spring the surprise of the weekend. 1-0 win for them.
Yeah, I kind of introed on the fact that Arsenal got the record. I think it was 54,115. New Women's Super League record attendance, amazing. Everything off the pitch at Arsenal is going really well. They've got their marketing spot on. There's a really good vibe around the club. The people are paying to come and watch the team. Great. Can you win now? Is kind of the problem, I think. The background to this, which a lot of listeners might have missed. I mean, frankly, I don't blame you. 20 days after the World Cup final, they were already out of the Champions League because they had to go through this ridiculously convoluted, difficult pre-qualifying phase. So that's already like one of your major competitions out, and it's also something that really captures the imagination of the fans. One of their very best moments last season was when they sold out the Emirates for the Champions League semi-final against Wolfsburg. You aren't going to get one of them this year because you aren't in it.
And of course, in that match, just fell short again. So you get your big moment in the spotlight, you get the fans in, and you just fall that little bit short and you lose that momentum.
Yeah, so I think it is. I think it's that fear of that momentum losing. I mean, it is ridiculous that we say, right, they've lost one game to... Actually, we shouldn't downplay the Liverpool team. I think I counted they were missing seven players. They'd had like a mini COVID outbreak. They'd had injuries. And they performed brilliantly. Like, Arsenal had something crazy like 19 corners, but that's kind of all they had. They really limited Arsenal to out wide crosses, and they backed themselves to defend. That's what Matt Beard said after the game. They backed themselves to not concede, and that's exactly what they did. It seems ridiculous to talk about pressure on a manager and sort of slightly not a crisis. That's a bit too hyperbolic, but we're not far off.
See, I knew you could do it. I said there was only one game, and you needed to extrapolate a big storyline, and you're about to say it's all over for Jonas Arnevald.
But genuinely, Chelsea dropped 8 points in the entirety of the Women's Super League campaign last season. Arsenal have already dropped 3. So now you only have 5 to play with in your next however many games.
21.
The math is not mathing this morning. So you are already under pressure. He knows that. He said, look, there's nobody putting more pressure on me than myself to get these wins. And he called for patience for the fans that had turned up. You know, obviously when you get that many fans, you want to put on a good show, you want to get them to come back. I think they will anyway, to be honest, because it's just a nice atmosphere at women's game. Obviously they, you know, enjoyed it regardless, but you want to be winning the games, and they're playing Manchester United on Friday. I'll be there at Leeds Sports Village. Not quite the Emirates, but if they then lose that game, it's suddenly like disaster. 2 games into a season.
Right, we'll see what the future holds for Arsenal. But not wanting to make too many big judgments after the opening weekend, I want to talk about the women's game broadly. Obviously, we're just fresh from a World Cup and England reaching the final, which followed hot on the heels of a triumph in the Euros. And we're always talking, aren't we? How do we grow the women's game? What's the next step for the women's game? And you mentioned there the Emirates and the big crowd, 54,000. Gregor, you were at Chelsea, where there was 14,000. And Emma Hayes had some views on that idea of growing the game, getting fans in, and the cost of tickets as well. Because, Molly, you know, a lot of these games and pushes, these promotional pushes to get people in the stands come with cheaper tickets, offers for younger kids, which is great. But Emma Hayes, Gregor, had some views on that going forward and the sustainability of it.
Yeah, I mean, just for context, the same game last November against Spurs, which was the last time they played the WSL game at Stamford Bridge, there were 38,000 fans there. So we were all kind of scratching our head a little bit afterwards, thinking, why has it dropped off so dramatically? And there are some unique sort of circumstances in WSL games. There's younger demographic, Sunday night, Sunday evening game. Some people might have been dissuaded from that. But it's a big drop. And there had been an uplift in ticket prices. It's pretty marginal. I mean, most of the issues, there were sort of complaints by the Chelsea Women's Supporters Group about the concession, a rise in concession prices at Kingsmead ordinarily. But they rose about £2 or £3 from last season generally. There was also a new kind of £50 ticket, which people sort of raised their eyebrows at. But
you were also talking about the timing issue as well. Potentially the game being a bit later, maybe getting parents getting kids in on a Sunday night before school.
But the thing that, I mean, Emma Hayes said last year that we need to put a value on this, basically, and she doubled down on that before the game when it was the question was put to her, and she said it again afterwards. She was like, I think £12, which is the minimum price for elite level football, is fair, and I realise we're in a cost of living crisis. But we need. She was saying it's like it's going to be a learning curve. We need to figure out, the balance between getting people in and getting, you know, drawing people to games so that they'll come again, and putting a value on it because they're also loss making. She said it costs £300,000 to open the stadium, and they need to earn some of that back. So as Molly knows better than anyone, it's a kind of question that women's football's been wrestling with for quite some time, and this was sort of maybe. Although it was still a head scratcher, still we talked beforehand. We were still not entirely sure why it was such a big drop off, but it was also a game on the TV. But you know, it's still a question going forward that people don't really have any answers to.
Having just said my math wasn't mathing this morning, I'm now going to do some math.
Do it.
So Emma Hayes' argument was that at £12 for Chelsea, that was the right price point, which is a little bit more expensive, not much, as Gregor said. I think part of it, I saw lots of screenshots of these £50 tickets on Twitter, or X, or whatever we're calling it. I think that put people off.
Yeah.
I think people didn't actually go and look for tickets because they thought all of the tickets were £50.
Part of it is kind of like the perception. And also, you have to admit, although we're talking about the men's game, Chelsea also scrapped the subsidised coach travel this summer, and you know, as they've just continued to take their transfer spend over £1 billion, so the whole kind of new ownership, hovering above Stamford Bridge, that is a bit of a cloud now, and that might have been another sort of factor in dissuading people.
What's the general view on playing matches at the men's stadium, if you like getting a balance right, so that it's not, seems to me it's still like seen as a bit like a quirky and a novelty as opposed to a right? And how many games per season do you think you should play at the major stadium before it's... Well, I mean, would Arsenal get that many people if they played 20 games there or 10 games there?
Yeah, so Arsenal have signed up or guaranteed whatever that they're going to play 5 league games there this season. Obviously, there's only 11, if my math is mathing once again. So that's nearly half of your home games that they've guaranteed they're going to play at the Emirates this season.
That sounds about right to me.
Chelsea 4, but Bristol City and Leicester playing all of them. They've committed to all of them.
And that doesn't really work. Leicester City really struggled last season, but Leicester City were also awful last season. So I think that plays a part. And you also have to remember, because of what we all talk about, even for us, a lot of people that listen to this podcast will care about women's football at major tournaments. They'll care about the Lionesses. So people will go and watch the Lionesses because they watch them on TV in the summer. Lots of Lionesses at Chelsea, Arsenal. Not any Lionesses at Leicester. So it's harder to sell for clubs further down the league. But those five games at the Emirates, they're doing a package where it's £5 for £50. And it sounds as though those packages have sold really well. So that's £10 a game. So we're not talking massively, you know, away from that £12 figure that Emma Hayes was talking about. So I think that's where she's underplaying it slightly, because she's sort of saying, well, it doesn't make a profit. But Arsenal got 54,000 there yesterday. Say they're £10 a ticket, which they're not. They're actually more than that in general sale. But say they've all £5 for £50, just for my poor maths.
Easy maths, yes.
That's £540,000. It doesn't cost that much to open the Emirates. The Arsenal have previously said to me, roughly, you need to get over 10,000 there to make it work, because then obviously once you've got over 10,000, you have to open another stand, pay more staff, etc., etc. But Arsenal are making a profit. They were making a profit last season. So I appreciate and completely understand what Emma Hayes is saying, but for me, fill your stadium with cheaper tickets first, make a good product for the TV, because I came home from the Emirates yesterday, I put the Chelsea game on Sky and I thought, that looks rubbish, there's nobody there. So if you're going to play in big stadiums, fill them. Not saying free tickets, because that doesn't work, we all know people don't turn up. But do it cheaper, you've got the established base like Arsenal have now, where I would say a lot of those fans yesterday weren't first-time fans, they'd come last season. Then they come again, and you've got the established support base to then increase your prices. Chelsea are doing it. They've increased the prices before they've got the established support base at Stamford Bridge. I understand, for me, that's a completely different argument, increasing it at King's Meadow, because I think that's absolutely right. They've outgrown King's Meadow. But, you know, that, and I guess to answer your question, Alison, I think that's one of the biggest problems for the women's game moving forward, especially for the big teams, because the little teams aren't quite there yet. But the big teams are outselling their small stadiums, and they're not quite ready to play at the big stadiums every week. You're going back to the Joe Montemurro, the former Arsenal manager, always used to talk about this kind of utopia of like a little medium-sized stadium.
Emma Hayes has referenced that too, I think, yeah.
Everyone would love one of those.
Only City have got one kind of, haven't they, in the academy stadium.
But that's pretty small, I think. I think in 7, terms of 000. Capacity, it's not massive. Yeah, so it's essentially a training stadium, really. Yeah.
But cost is definitely a big thing. I spoke to lots of fans before the game, and there were like, you know, a family of five there, and the guy was saying like it cost them under £60 or something to bring the whole family, and you know that would be like half the price of a one ticket for a top level men's game. That, and he's, you know, so a lot of them are fans of the men's team as well. But they're also maybe feel kind of like old as well. Like I was speaking to another family and. You're absolutely right about the draw of the Lionesses. I mean, that's part of the reason I went, is to see if there's kind of any World Cup effect, which was a bit odd when, as we're talking about crowds dropping. But I did speak to people who were there for the first time, and one girl, Maisie, who's 13, she was there to see Millie Bright. She'd persuaded her dad to drive her up from Southampton, go to the players' hotel beforehand, you know, wait outside, get her new strip that she had with Bright on the back and the number 4, get that signed. Then come to our first ever game, and it's because she'd followed all the players on TikTok, and she loved Millie Bright. She thought she was a great player, but she's also really funny. So it's like you realise the draw.
I keep telling you, TikTok.
You realise the draw is about the kind of individual personalities and of the Lionesses as well. And I spoke to another family who met Hannah Hampton on holiday, and he said that she was brilliant. Kids were coming up to her all the time. And she, you know, although she's on holiday, she was totally open with her time and, you know, answering questions. They said she was brilliant, and they kind of became friends with her. And so that's still, I went there thinking, surely the Euros has been the thing that's, you know, given it a real boost. But that never ends. You know, there's another kind of generation who maybe that even a year ago were too young to really get to grips with that, and seeing the World Cup this year. It's all about, you know, the players are still feel it as part of their job to sell and grow the game. and that journey is never ending.
There you go, game podcast listeners. Three different solutions to the refereeing crisis in the men's Premier League and only one game into the Women's Super League, and we've already sorted out the financial future of the women's game. But if you're still not happy, you can get in touch with me on Twitter or email me tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk to make any suggestions around future content, or just say, why the hell haven't you mentioned my team? And we'll try and correct it in the future. Molly Hudson, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robson, thank you for joining me. We'll be back on Thursday to discuss all the latest Champions League action. See you then.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.